Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
David Shipler reported for the New York Times from 1966 to 1988 in New York, Saigon, Moscow, Jerusalem, and Washington, D.C. He is the author of six previous books, including the bestsellers Russia and the Working Poor, as well as Arab and Jew, which won the Pulitzer Prize. His new book is Rights at Risk: The Limits of Liberty in Modern America. While the book came out 3 years ago, it has just been released in paperback. It is an examination of violations of the constitutional principles that preserve individual rights and civil liberties, from courtrooms to classrooms. Again, the title of the book is Rights at Risk, and we welcome David Shipler to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, I'm happy to be with you. Thanks.
Very nice to have you with us. This book originally came out in hardcover about 3 years ago, and I'm interested in what you think the last few years has brought when it comes to our rights.
Not a great deal of change. You know, the book deals with the criminal justice system and, you know, kind of looks at the Bill of Rights as played out in everyday America and people's lives. So I wouldn't say there have been dramatic changes. I think our attention has been focused recently on racial problems in police departments, and that certainly is a change, not that the situation is new, but that we are paying much more attention to it in light of the killings of unarmed black men in several parts of the country. So that, I think, is, and the Justice Department, as you know, has recently issued a scathing report on Ferguson, Missouri, noting that not only was there obvious racism in the police department itself, but also the local judicial system and the city budget depended on arresting and fining people for minor infractions to generate income. So, I mean, it's like a whole systemic problem that has come to light. Now, what is to be done about it is a question, because it wouldn't be new to say or amazing to say that we've discovered repeatedly problems in police departments and other elements of the criminal justice system, and we've gotten very upset about them. And then our attention span is pretty short, so we then go on to other issues and no basic change takes place. So I don't want to be cynical about this, but I think there's a lot of work to be done, and it's going to take years to make reforms.
You do make the point in a recent article that you've written on this very topic that the Justice Department could actually change something for real if they took a page from the Defense Department's book.
Yes, you know, for almost 30 years, I think the Defense Department has had an institute at Petrick Air Force Base in Florida called the Defense Equal Opportunity Management Institute. They use the acronym DEOMI. And I spent time there when I was doing a book on racial prejudice and stereotyping some years ago. I spent quite a lot of time down there sitting in on training sessions. They bring members of the military in for either a week or two, or sometimes as long as 7 or 8 weeks, and train them in the patterns and dynamics of racial stereotyping and gender stereotyping as well, and then send them back into their units to educate others in their units. And I think that the military has really put a lot of effort into the basic idea that you can think whatever you want to about people who are different from you. That's your business, but what you do is our business. How you behave is our business. And I think the same approach could be taken with police departments. Some do good training, and some actually send officers to DEOMI to be trained. I mean, DEOMI is open to civilians to an extent, and I was there actually when several officers from the Hartford, Connecticut Police Department were there being trained. So that's an option, and I think that states could set up institutes of this kind, or they could incorporate training on racial stereotyping and interactions into their police academies much more extensively than is now the case. The Justice Department could certainly establish such an institute. I mean, there are ways of dealing with this. I don't think you know, we need to throw up our hands in despair and figure, well, this is just part of the landscape and we can't do anything about it. I think there are reforms that can be made. And a lot of police departments have tried and tried successfully to make change. It often depends on the police chief or the police commissioner. Leadership at the top sets a tone that trickles down into the ranks. When you have at roll call, for example, the sergeant on duty making slurs against blacks, and black police officers have in various places have told me that this happens, you set a tone that is almost permissive in terms of allowing your officers to go on the basis of their assumptions that if they see a young black guy on the street and he's not being particularly cooperative, he's automatically violent. You know, violence is one of the major stereotypes in the panorama of stereotypes that have traditionally been used against blacks. So when a police officer confronts a black person, a black male particularly, he may automatically fear that that person is armed or being or about to be violent or put the officer at risk. The officer's threshold of action is lower in that kind of situation. I mean, there have been cases where black undercover officers in civilian clothes have been shot and killed or seriously wounded by white police officers because the white officers assume that the black guy who's acting the way he is actually a criminal when he's actually a cop. So I think these racial assumptions are powerful and they need to be addressed.
You start off that article by saying that the most racist institutions in America are police departments. And I'm interested within criminal justice institutions of how close and how many ingredients are similar to the problems in the other institutions that you write about in the book.
I think that the problems are similar, but the solutions are lacking in police departments. That would be my quick summation. That is, we all grow up with stereotypes. All of us have been taught and raised to think in patterns about groups of people. I mean, I don't think there are any exceptions to this. I mean, people, we all fall along different parts of the spectrum in that regard, and each of us has our individual levels of introspection or self-awareness about our thoughts. But the society, you know, is just as full of stereotypes. I mean, we've seen it since Obama came into office. If you go on the internet, I mean, you see horrible caricatures of Obama and Michelle Obama, you know, and racist things being said and so forth. It's all there. We just had the University of Oklahoma fraternity guys, a couple of them making a video with racist slurs. So I think that the issue really isn't so much that it exists in some places and doesn't in others. It's really a matter of the superstructure that we build inside institutions and in the society as a whole to inhibit the expression of these attitudes. So, for example, the military realized decades ago that it had a stake in making sure that minorities and women felt integrated and part of the whole and not discriminated against or marginalized. Now, obviously, the military has a huge problem with sexual assault, so they certainly haven't solved these issues, but they've worked very hard at them. I think many corporations, especially the largest corporations, a couple of decades ago began to look around the pool of talent in terms of its workforce and also the pool of its customer base and realized, you know, if we exclude blacks, if we exclude women, we're cutting ourselves off from a pool of important talent and also profits. So many corporations also do diversity training and try very hard to get the idea across to their employees that discrimination or discriminatory behavior is just not going to be tolerated, and it's going to damage your career if it happens. So I think just to bring it into the book that's just come out in paperback, Rights at Risk, it's pretty clear that blacks in the criminal justice system have a particular problem, and it's partly because of race and partly because of class. You know, the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution provides the right to counsel. That is, everyone who is a defendant in a criminal case has the right to a lawyer. But it doesn't actually say that you have a right to a good lawyer. And what's happened in the country is, based on a Supreme Court decision 30, 40 years ago, the state, the government, has to pay for a lawyer if you can't afford one. But different states have different systems of providing lawyers, and not many of them have full-time defense attorneys in a public defender system the way the federal system does. If you're accused of a crime in a federal court, in almost all of the federal districts, you're going to get a pretty good lawyer at the expense of the government if you can't afford to pay one yourself. But if you, for example, or I don't know the situation in every single state, but in Alabama, for example, by and large, you will get a lawyer who is a private lawyer who's on a list that the judge draws from and can pay only a fraction of what that lawyer might get from a private client. And so the lawyer might not do a great job, might not spend a lot of time with you, might not have the money to do an investigation of your case. And legal defense involves doing investigations, duplicating the police investigation, in a sense, to try to turn up evidence of your innocence. So all of that, I think, works more strongly against African Americans than it does against whites, simply because of the lower socioeconomic level that many African Americans occupy in many parts of the country.
I'm curious as to, and I know we discussed this the last time you were on the program, but how things changed post 9/11. And because it seems in reading the book that, yes, there was change, but the building blocks were there before it.
That's right. I think you put it very well. I mean, the major change after 9/11 took place in the abuse of the Fourth Amendment, which prohibits illegal searches. In other words, to get a search warrant or to do a search, that is a search of your home, a search of your office, a search of your electronic files, a search of your automobile, a search of you if you're walking along the street. For the police or the FBI or any law enforcement authority to do that kind of search, there has to be, according to the Fourth Amendment, what's called probable cause. Probable cause meaning more than a 51% probability that evidence of a crime will be found. Now, probable cause is a concept that is enforced by the system of search warrants. So, you know, in general, the police can't come into your house and do a search without getting a warrant from a judge. And to get a warrant, an officer has to swear in an affidavit that there is probable cause to believe evidence of a crime will be found. And the search warrant generally limits the kind of things that can be seized in your house. You know, it's sort of a restriction on to those things that are relevant to the particular crime that's being investigated. What happened after 9/11 was that because of this digital world we live in, the National Security Agency, at first without any legal authorization and then with legal authorization, expanded its ability to search your computer records, that is your website browsing activity, your cell phone activity, the email addresses that you communicate with, and so forth, quite extensively. And since Edward Snowden revealed certain aspects of this, we know that they were actually picking up what's called metadata from virtually all email and telephone calls in the United States. Metadata meaning the phone number you called or that called you, the email address that you used or communicated with, and the subject line of the email, by the way. So that's something to think about if you're writing an email, what right to put in that subject line. So I think that what this is an outgrowth of an erosion of the Fourth Amendment on the streets, because, you know, I spent time with a couple of police units in Washington, D.C. One in particular was assigned to get guns off of people in very bad and dangerous neighborhoods. And here, too, you have a racial consideration because they didn't do this in white neighborhoods of D.C. They did it in black neighborhoods. And what they would do is they would pull up this unit. They'd be in marked cars and in uniform because they wanted to see how people reacted to them when they appeared. And they'd pull up and they'd kind of watch people hanging out on the street on a summer night and see how they behaved. And if they, you know, kind of walked away or if they touched their waistband repeatedly, you know, the cops would think, well, maybe that guy has a gun. And people were so used to the police coming and searching them without any cause. I mean, they had no cause to do these searches. And they're supposed to have what's called reasonable suspicion in the case law. That is, reasonable suspicion to think that you're armed. That justifies a search of a pedestrian without a warrant. But they didn't have that. I mean, they just, you know, they would come up and talk to these guys. And these young fellows who were hanging around on street corners got to the point they were so used to this that when the cops pulled up, they'd just pick up their T-shirts without even being asked to show that they didn't have guns in their waistbands. So I would say that if that happened in a white neighborhood of Washington, D.C., such as Georgetown or Capitol Hill, there'd be a big outcry and an uproar by, you know, white middle-class or middle-upper-class people who felt that their rights were being violated. So I think that we have, you know, in this country, we have different levels of justice. And that search procedure to try to get guns off people and the search for drugs as well comes out of the war on drugs. I mean, it does, as you say, it predates 9/11. One federal judge in D.C. told me that he said the Fourth Amendment almost doesn't exist anymore in criminal law. And that's a pretty shocking statement from a federal judge. He was lamenting the fact. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't endorsing it, but he said that's the fact. You know, the Fourth Amendment has been really shredded by the war on drugs and then the post-9/11 situation.
We started off our discussion by talking about what has happened over the past few years since the book originally came out in hardcover. So with the title, Rights at Risk, do you think they always will be at risk?
That's a good question. I think they've always been at risk to a certain extent. That is, we've always struggled to find the right balance between security and liberty. And we go through different eras and different times of history when one seems to be more important than the other. And a time of terrorism is a time of fear, which induces us to give up some of our freedoms, we think, in exchange for more security. My own feeling is that sometimes we make this security-liberty issue into too much of a dichotomy or a zero-sum game. I don't think it's quite that simple, and I'll give you an example. One of the areas of concern now, and I think it's always been the case, is the methods of police interrogation, which the courts have allowed to, I think, stray into areas of abuse. You know, we have the Miranda warning. The Miranda warning says, as we all know because we've watched enough television, you have the right to remain silent, you have the right to an attorney. If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be provided for you, and that covers the Fifth Amendment, which protects us against being forced to incriminate ourselves. That was devised because of torture, and the Sixth Amendment, which provides for counsel because the legal system is complex. You know, no layman can really thread his way through it. It's a labyrinth. Well, what happens, in fact, is that the police often will say to a defendant, well, you know, or someone who's been arrested, not yet a defendant, but somebody who's under arrest, well, you know, look, here are your rights. I got to read you your rights. You know this system. You know, just sign the waiver, and then we'll get on with this and get it over with as quickly as we can. And then they'll start asking questions about the details of the crime and where the person was, and they might even, the courts allow them to fake evidence or to pretend to have, I shouldn't say fake evidence, but to pretend to have evidence that they don't have. For example, an officer can wave a piece of paper and say, look, this is the lab tests showing that your blood was found at the scene. Now, he can't actually type up a lab report that says that, but he can pretend to have such a report. He can wave a DVD and he can say, this shows, the security camera shows that you were at the store during the robbery. What do you say to that? And he can't, you know, fake a video, but he can pretend to the person who's under arrest that he's got it. He can even say, you know, that your buddy is ratting on you and he's, you know, getting a better deal because he's speaking first. You better come clean. And there are training programs, by the way, to teach officers how to do these interrogations. I mean, one of the things they suggest is that they use a tactic called minimization. That is, they try to minimize the responsibility of the person under arrest by saying, well, it probably wasn't your idea, was it? It was probably your buddy's idea, or maybe it was self-defense. I mean, you felt threatened, so you stabbed the guy. Some kind of excuse to make the defendant feel that the cop is on his side and he's trying to kind of chart an exit strategy for this person who's under arrest. Well, the problem here is that, especially with children who are interrogated this way often, and mentally ill or mentally retarded people, but also sometimes with mature, mentally healthy adults, people will confess falsely. And what's interesting is that the convictions that have been reversed by DNA evidence, and DNA evidence is the best forensic evidence we have now, convictions that have been reversed by the courts, and it's not easy to get a conviction reversed, now number in the hundreds, and 25% of them involved false confessions, where the defendant in a, say, in a murder case or a rape case, who could not possibly have been the perpetrator because his DNA doesn't match, actually confessed falsely. A very famous case, which has gotten a lot of recent publicity, is the Central Park jogger case, where a young white woman was assaulted brutally in Central Park, and five young black and Hispanic guys were arrested, interrogated separately, and each of them confessed, although, in fact, there was no forensic evidence at all that linked them to the crime, and in fact, the details that they gave of the crime, such as the time and place, didn't match up with reality, but based on those confessions, they were sentenced to long prison terms, and they stayed in jail until the real culprit, who was in prison for another crime, confessed. And so what happened in that case, and this is why I don't think security and liberty are mutually exclusive, what happened in that case is that while these five guys were being arrested and prosecuted, the real culprit was still out on the streets attacking people. And in fact, he raped and murdered a pregnant woman. So violating the Fifth Amendment, which I think they did, I think the police, in effect, in spirit at least, not legally, but in spirit, violated the Fifth Amendment, violating the rights of these five young men did not make the society more secure. It made it less secure because the police stopped looking after they arrested them. So I think that we have to take a very kind of nuanced view of liberty versus security and understand that, in fact, our liberties protect our security in many cases. So to abandon them or to take shortcuts past them, I think, is a very serious error, and it's one we've been making pretty routinely throughout our history, but particularly since 9/11.
David Shipler's new book is Rights at Risk, The Limits of Liberty in Modern America. It is just out in paperback from Vintage. David, thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book is Rights at Risk, The Limits of Liberty in Modern America. It is published by Vintage. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.